If you're hearing this, it means that you're subscribed to the public podcast feed and only getting part of the conversation. If you'd like to listen to the full episode and gain exclusive access to the first 100 episode archive, consider becoming part of the pack over at patreon.com/howlinthewilderness. Welcome to the Howl in the Wilderness podcast. I'm your host, Brian James. Howl in the Wilderness features deep and insightful conversations with renegade artists, philosophers, psychologists, and spiritual teachers who are working on the edge of dominant culture to recover and revive soul in people and the planet. On this episode, I speak with cultural historian and archetypal astrologer Richard Tarnas about his book Cosmos and Psyche, his journey from Harvard to Esalen in the 1970s, and how his psychedelic research with Stanislav Grof and encounter with James Hillman were integral to the development of what he calls archetypal cosmology. I really enjoyed this conversation, and it was an honor to have such a deep and personal conversation with someone whose depth of experience, scholarship, and concern for humanity is truly humbling. As usual, this episode is made possible through the generous support of the Howl in the Wilderness Patreon community. If you'd like to enjoy early release of full ad-free episodes and access the archive of the first 100 episodes of the podcast, please consider becoming part of the pack over at patreon.com/howlinthewilderness. Thanks for listening. Enjoy. Richard Tarnas, welcome to the podcast, and thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me.
My pleasure and honor. Thank you for inviting me.
Mm-hmm. Well, it feels like it's been a long time coming, but interesting story. My wife and I were talking about you and how we got introduced to your work. I was in a used bookstore in Montreal about maybe 6 years ago. And as I was checking out with my books, I noticed near the front counter this impressive looking book called Cosmos and Psyche. And I was struck by it, not only due to its size, it looked like it was a serious book, but the title captivated me. I was starting to really get into depth psychology. And also as a designer, the cover grabbed my attention too. I thought, this looks like my kind of book. It looks like a significant book. It's very compelling. So I bought it and I brought it home to my wife, who's a professional astrologer. And I said, have you ever heard of this guy or this book? And she said, oh yeah, but I don't think she had read your work at that point. And so we've had that book since. And she's read it and gone deeply into your work and exploring more of a depth psychological approach to astrology. And of course, as I've really got into depth psychology, you can't help but encounter the planets at some point in the writing of Jung and Hillman and Thomas More, some of my favorite teachers. The book itself was a little imposing to me. I married into astrology and I've picked up some through osmosis, through our conversations. But the technical aspects are very daunting. It's such a complex system. But I've always felt that it was probably perhaps the most complete archetypal system that we have to work with. And it's always impressed me as that. And so I remain curious and have started tiptoeing into some of the deeper aspects of astrology beyond just looking at the planetary archetypes. And I've been getting into Cosmos and Psyche at long last in some of your other articles. And I find them really compelling. And some of the ideas you put forward seem very relevant to the work that I do, particularly in transformative space, like working with psychedelics and plant medicines and shamanism, and I would say even yoga. So I thought maybe we could kind of circle around some of those topics during this conversation. And I thought a good way to jump in maybe is going back in your history to when you arrived at Esalen from your studies at Harvard. I've been to Esalen. I've taught there a few times. I think it's an amazing place. And the history there, I could feel it, you know, teaching yoga in the Huxley room and thinking about Aldous Huxley and the gatherings that must have happened there over the years. I'd love to hear from you what it was like to arrive at Esalen in the 1970s from the East Coast.
Thank you for the background there. Quick question on the so you found the cover of the of Cosmos and Psyche and the design something that you kind of drew you in. Is that what you were saying? You know, the image on the front. I actually conceived and drew up, and had a pretty good version of it through that I asked an artist to do. But of course, Random House, the Viking Penguin, the publishers, they have their own designers, and so they tweaked it in their ways, mainly kind of taking my mind was a little more vivid, but I'm just curious what your what it was about the cover that pulled you in.
Well, I think the boldness of a mostly predominantly black cover with these two figures, a god and goddess, kind of reaching toward, I guess it's the earth, and also the kind of elegance of the typography. Really stood out to me. It didn't look like a kind of typical New Age publication. It looked like a serious book, and aesthetically it looked sophisticated.
Well, that's good to know. I wanted to convey the idea of both the cosmos, the solar system, but also the anima mundi, you know, the presence of the gods, the reality of them, the association with the heavens. And also the focus on the earth, which is kind of a paradigm shifter as well, just, you know, compared with the characteristically modern understanding of the earth as just being, you know, one more planet in a decentered universe that's, and it's going around an undistinguished star, one of several planets. And that star is one of billions and billions, and another that, you know, just the ultimately decentered universe that has no focus on the earth or on human beings or on human consciousness. It's all in an indifferent context cosmically. The idea that the earth could be a center of cosmic meaning, and that individuals could be, as seen in their birth charts, and the idea that the world, the cosmos, can speak symbolically, which all indigenous peoples believed were embedded in an enchanted world, an ensouled world, and so the astrological evidence points to some suddenly that the earth itself can be a moving center of cosmic meaning, and that instead of being isolated as a kind of bizarrely, absurdly conscious, purposeful, meaning-seeking entity in a vast, vast cosmos that is purposeless and unconscious and intrinsically meaningless. It's a paradigm challenger, just that very, the very existence of the nature of the evidence. So I'm glad that the cover conveyed something implicitly in that way.
There's something striking in that image too, that the gods are reaching toward us on planet Earth. It's not just us looking up to the stars looking for meaning, but perhaps those entities, those powers are also looking to us for something, some expression in the world or some appreciation, maybe some acknowledgement, some care and feeding. I don't know, but that's striking as well, that they're reaching toward us.
Right, that it's a relationship, which is not something that is part of the mainstream scientific understanding, other than a subject-object relationship where you have an instrumental relationship to an objective world that you can rationally comprehend and control, predict, exploit, etc. But instead that there is a relational, a mutuality to the relationship. And I think in addition to the what you were just describing as the that it's going two ways and that there are ways in which we it that the transcendent or the archetypal is in some sense inviting or looking to the human being for something, that it's not just a one-way street. That I think I would add the word participation too, that through a more conscious attitude and awareness of the powerful archetypal forces in our depths and in the cosmos, the more aware we are of them, and also the aware of the multivalent range of ways that archetypes, any particular archetype or archetypal complex, can be enacted. They can be acted out in quite destructive ways that sort of reflect like the shadow side of it. And then there's also life-enhancing creative ways. And our response to our enactment, embodiment of these powerful energies that can come through in very different ways, that allows us to have a participatory role in the unfolding of the anima mundi, of the soul of the world, rather than just be puppets of it, which is, you know, basically what Jung was saying. In a way, the whole depth psychology project is about bringing greater awareness to those archetypal depths so that we are not just puppets of things that we're not even aware of, we're not respectful of, etc., in the confidence of being modern man, put quotes around the word man, with its kind of masculine, courageous, heroic image of the human being in a vast, indifferent universe. It's a very different relationship to the soul of the world, to the transcendent. It acknowledges that it exists, which is not something that the modern mindset not acknowledges, because it just sees the world as more mechanistic, unconscious. Well, getting back to your primary question.
I did want to go there in terms of evolution of consciousness and all of that. I mean, we could stick with it, or we could kind of back into personal history. Maybe
we can
come
hit
back
the
around
personal
to
history,
it.
And I'm sure the evolutionary side of it is going to come up again, and we'll just resume. So, yeah, the background, you know. On the one hand, you could say going from the East Coast academic world of Harvard to the West Coast, highly counterculturally adventurous world of Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California, that was a big paradigm shift in itself and a culture clash. But it wasn't as much as it would have been in any other era, in a way, because, you know, I went to university in the late 1960s or early 1970s, like 1968 to 72 is when I was at Harvard. And that was pretty much the height of the 60s counterculture, and the psychedelic revolution had major roots at Harvard.
Alpert and Leary were there.
Exactly. And, you know, Richard Alpert came back from India as Ram Dass right when I was there. I met him at the end of my first LSD trip, actually. So there was a period when both psychedelics and Eastern mystical traditions, radical politics, new attitudes about the psyche, radical psychology, you know, R.D. Lang, Alan Watts,
Jung, Fritz Perls, and
Fritz Perls as well. They were all in the air at that time. We were reading them, and then turned out Esalen was where a lot of these people were teaching, like Alan Watts or Fritz Perls or Joseph Campbell,
Maslow,
Gregory Bateson, etc. So there was a continuity there. And actually, in my freshman year, I was remembering this the other day, there was a big two-installment essay, and it was also two big pages of the Harvard Crimson newspaper during my freshman year, two installments of a large essay in which the headline was, "After Harvard, Esalen?" And I read that, and it was
took
a very
it personally.
I may have been the only person that actually took that up. But I read that, and was very moved by the description of the courage of what people were doing at Esalen at that point, and sort of made a mental note, like, after I graduate here, I'd like to go out to the West Coast and visit that place. Then I also later heard about the work of Stanislav Grof. He hadn't published anything yet, but Abraham Maslow had read his early manuscript that summarized Stan Grof's research, and Maslow said, "This is the most important contribution to psychological theory thinking since for generations," or something like that, "since Freud," or for several decades, some strong statement like that. And I read a little bit more. I thought, wow, anybody who has worked with LSD day after day, thousands of sessions with people of so many categories of, you know, psychiatric categories, neurotic, psychotics, different presenting symptoms and syndromes, but also worked with scientists and artists and so forth who were curious, ministers, philosophers who are curious about the psychedelic experience. But for him to have sat and worked as a psychiatrist, a therapist, with so many people using such a powerful medicine, one that if in the wrong hands or at the wrong time or if it's not properly prepared for and contained, can be quite destabilizing and problematic of an experience. For him to have done such impressive work for so many years and then pull it all together in both a new form of psychotherapy with very specific recommendations, which are largely being integrated now in the psychedelic renaissance that's taking place in our time, now 50 years later. But he also came up with a powerful understanding of the psyche, a map of the psyche, which he would call a cartography of the psyche and of the deep unconscious, which basically integrated Freud and Jung and other major psychologists from the from the depth psychology tradition, Otto Rank and Melanie Klein and so forth, Wilhelm Reich. And then at the same time, in a very compelling and detailed way, integrated that with an mystical understandings of the nature of the universe and of human consciousness and their relation that come from the Asian mystical traditions, but also his assimilation of ancient death rebirth mystery cults and the mystery religions, but also shamanic and shamanic rites of passage, initiatory rituals, and so forth. And to have all that pulled together in such a powerfully coherent way, because I majored in psychology, I was very interested in the in that kind of Western trajectory, and at the same time was deeply pulled in by, you know, the mystical traditions, as many people were at that time and continue to be. So I thought I'd like to meet him, and I wrote to him at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center, which is where or Research Institute, which is where he, for several years after leaving Prague, he was working while teaching at Johns Hopkins, but he was overseeing a psychedelic therapy program under an NIMH, that's a National Institute of Mental Health program. And so he'd been there since 67. So I wrote him in what that would have been 73. And his letter came back from Esalen, where he had just moved, and said, I've moved out here now, where I've been, you know, given a house and a grant to bring into publication my research and my books. And he said, I'd be very happy to meet you if you, come through. And so I decided that's what I'll do. My graduate program let me go there and basically almost turn Esalen into my graduate school, so that I studied closely with Stan, with Joe Campbell, with Gregory Bateson, and Houston Smith. Later years, I invited James Hillman to come there, and he it became my graduate school, and then where I began teaching, and I started, became the director of programs there for several years and so forth, and then began my life work of writing first Passion of the Western Mind, and then Cosmos and Psyche. And then I've got hopefully a couple more that I'd like to bring out while my mind is still lucid and I'm still energetically enough capable of that kind of energetic creativity that's necessary to publish a book or write a book.
Mm-hmm. Especially the type of books that you produce. A lot of work.
Yeah. I seem to be drawn to, you know, we all have a daimon that requires us to go a certain direction, and that seems to be mine.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Not
so that's the background. So then I came to Esalen, and really things just opened up on a whole new level. That's where my research began with Stan, that led towards the kind of synthesis of, because neither of us took astrology seriously really before then, but we were looking in particular, and maybe this gets to another part of your interests around you know, psychedelics as well as astrology and depth psychology, and that is that we discovered, much to our shock, that in our attempt to understand why this enduring problem that psychotherapists had, the psychologists doing tests and so forth with people who took psychedelics, were never able to find, there were no psychological tests that seemed to have any value for giving the researchers an intimation of how an individual person would respond to this powerful medicine. Two people could take the exact same drug, exact same dose, and have such radically different experiences, or the same person could have on at different times radically different experiences. And those of you out there in cyberland who have had psychedelic experiences know that it can range from heaven to hell, and that's not an exaggeration. I mean, it can be really euphorically, ecstatically, blissfully, infinitely heaven-like, and it also can be hellish in indescribable ways that you feel that you'll never get out of as well. And so there was a lot resting on this, on answering this question of like, to get a handle on how people might respond. And none of the traditional psychological tests like the Rorschach or the MMPI, Minnesota Multiphasic inventory, or several other kinds of tests that they tried, had any predictive value. And by contrast, you know, Esalen was a place where many esoteric and ancient systems, as well as kind of contemporary and postmodern practices, were being explored and take and honored in a certain way. There was a genuinely pluralistic, pragmatic attitude about that Esalen was carrying, and so a person who was in one of Stan's month-longs explained to Stan that in his experience, people's day-to-day experience and the major breakthroughs or crises of their lives seem to coincide with particular planetary transits. That is where the planets are at a given time in the sky relative to where they were at the person's birth, their horoscope or their natal chart. And the astrological traditions conviction that there were these fundamental cosmic connections between archetypal principles and or powers on the one hand and planets and their movements on the other, and that this would be this correlation would be expressed in human experience, in the patterns of a person's lifetime, in certain native predispositions that they have all their life, and then other things that seem to be much more dynamically shifting in the course of their life. In all those ways, it was a he was saying that if you can study the person's natal chart and transits, he said, I imagine you might get some insight as to what kinds of experiences people would be having. So we were open-mindedness. As Stan has said, and I have as well, astrology was kind of the last tradition, practice, perspective, frame of reference that we took seriously out of all the, you know, unconventional or ancient or esoteric traditions. Astrology seemed to us the most kind of, well, as I said, astrology is like the gold standard of superstition in our culture. It's really what, if you want to say something is not worth serious intellectual engagement because it just reflects superstitious beliefs, then you compare it to astrology. That's no better than astrology, you know, that kind of put down. And the fact is, you know, we, with our 20th century educations, had a similar conviction until we thought, well, let's do the due diligence as researchers, and we did. And fortunately, we had very good exact records of many sessions of Stan's own history, mine, but also at Esalen, you know, many people are there and having powerful experiences of all kinds, psychedelic and other transformational experiences. So we had quite a database, plus his history of psychiatric research with others, psychedelic therapy with the people in the past. So we started doing the research, and we're just blown away by both the consistency and the precision of the correlations. Not that the planetary movements and the archetypal patterns told us exactly the kind of experience a person would have, but it would give us, as I would say, it's not concretely predictive, it's archetypally predictive. It gives us the larger archetypal character of an experience, or the multiple archetypal factors that are collectively at work at any given time and in different weighting, different levels of intensity and so forth. And we were quite impressed. And so that started us off on many decades now of that kind of research. And we've taught, 30 years of graduate students here at CIA, where we taught California Institute of Integral Studies. We moved up to the Bay Area after being in Big Sur and Esalen in the 70s and 80s. In the 90s, we moved up to the San Francisco Bay Area, started teaching the graduate school, California Institute of Integral Studies. And we still have a graduate program called Philosophy, Cosmology, and Consciousness Program for PhDs and master's students. And by this point, hundreds of students who, like us, were interested in new paradigms. They were interested in addressing philosophy, cosmology, and consciousness issues, but they did not have astrology in their backpack. Now it's become a kind of lingua franca within the community. I mean, people, it's a very helpful way of grasping the complexity and of archetypal dynamics that we all share collectively with world transits, but also individually. We get our own versions of it according to the transits to our natal chart, personal transits, and then there's the lifelong tendencies that we all carry with our birth chart. So in ways that we just did not anticipate in earlier decades, starting in the mid-1970s, Stan and I became persuaded that this was an important avenue of research. And eventually, as Stan said, he came to feel, as I do, that it's a kind of archetypal astrology is a kind of Rosetta Stone of the psyche that allows us to, in some sense, read the language of the ensouled cosmos, which is a great privilege as well as a responsibility, that's a whole nother topic. But anyway, that was a long answer to your question about Harvard, Esalen, depth psychology, astrology, etc. But hopefully you got the narrative from what I said.
Yeah, that's great. I really appreciate how it's like both of you went to astrology kind of grudgingly. It's almost like something else was enlisting you. You didn't come in thinking, okay, we're going to use astrology. We're going to find these correlations that will help us gauge what kind of experience people are going to have. But you had to go back in the records forensically and, oh yeah, there are these correlations. And yeah. I mean, that's kind of interesting in terms of like Hillman's idea of the soul's code, how you kind of get called into service, sometimes often reluctantly.
Yes. Yeah. And, that's in the background, of course, of Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, very much like there's the call and then there can be the rejection that sometimes happens at an earlier point. And then,
right. The refusal of the call.
Exactly. Yeah. But Hillman kind of brings that fuller sense of the daimon in a very helpful way. I think just the way Louis Armstrong, orphan in New Orleans, just happens to be given a cornet by a charitable family, and changes the course of 20th century music.
I love the one he tells about, I think it's Manoletti, the Spanish bullfighter, I guess one of the greatest bullfighters of all time. But when he was a little kid, he was so timid, he used to hide behind his mother's apron, almost like the bullfighter's cape. It's sure. Like his soul knew what was in store for him. And that was really intimidating. I love those stories. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's quite remarkable. And for someone who's a very deconstructive sensibility like Hillman, for him to be offering such a teleological understanding of human life was kind of a new thing. And of course, he told me towards the end of his life, he said, you know, I've always been a Platonist.
And finally admitted it.
Yeah. And he recounted. And if you look at that, the talk that he gave, it's very worthwhile. It's been published, and I can't remember where it finally got published, but it's probably in the uniform edition of his works. But he, in the year of 2000, there was a big depth psychology conference in Santa Barbara that Hillman and Pacifica Graduate Institute, where both of us used to teach in Santa Barbara, they organized a conference called At the Threshold, I think that was the name of it, or Psychology at the Threshold, something like that. It was one of the only two archetypal psychology gatherings, festivals, conferences. The other one was in that brought the entire community together. The first one was in 92 in Notre Dame. So the second one was in 2000. And Hillman, for his keynote, gave a terrific presentation where he said, we need to posit three values as fundamental for psychology, for the soul. One is beauty, two is justice, and three is destiny. And I mean, you could hear him, of course, easily bringing in beauty as a kind of primordial sovereign principle for human beings and our imagination to orient ourselves around. Justice, I think that came in more after Revisioning Psychology, his early masterwork, and it became more and more part of his work as he worked in multiracial environments and, you know, just became and moved back to the United States and kind of tuned into that, the various social justice movements. And then, but destiny, even though he was such a vocal opponent of Jung's self archetype and individuation, but the daimon and destiny have a teleological element that's pretty continuous with what Jung had in mind too. But I think it's James's kind of postmodern way of entering back into this perspective that he didn't want to let get too close to Christian theology, which was his big bete noire.
Yeah, and also, you know, Jung's idea of the telos of the soul toward individuation, wholeness, integration, you know, Hillman rejected that. And I think his telos was like toward more eccentricity, toward That's more right. uniqueness, not necessarily good and perfect and whole and all of that. Right. So I think that's maybe how he was able to bring it in. Yeah. But it's interesting, right? Like he is very much like a son of like Aphrodite and Ares. Like he once said, I can't write unless I'm angry about something. Like he's so polemic in his writing and always an advocate for beauty. The destiny one is interesting. I mean, that was so central to him. One of the three values.
I think he had to recognize it as happening in his own life, and it as with all of us, we first get an insight that's relevant to our own life, and then that opens up the mind and the heart to be able to see that possibility as being more than just my personal idiosyncrasy, but it might be part of the human condition. And I think sometimes as one gets older, you live long enough that you start seeing like, oh, I see how this loss, this mistake, this tragedy in my life allowed this to happen, which is so central to everything I have become and that I'm grateful for. And to start to see the complex ways in which a kind of life narrative that has an inner coherence, a kind of aesthetic and spiritual coherence to it, it starts to emerge, and it's not as easy to see when one's younger. And then as we've got enough years behind us to get the longer view, and also to see so many other people's lives. And of course, if you're like James or myself as well, you read a lot of biographies. It's just of great interest, and it's pretty clear to see there too, if you read the biographies, how certain meetings happen, certain ideas come into a person's life that have such enormous repercussions, not just for that person's trajectory, but for the culture as a whole. I wrote a little chapter on synchronicity in Cosmos and Psyche, where I brought up the synchronicity that Saint Augustine had when he was going through his crisis, a spiritual crisis, really a perinatal crisis, where he's just hitting his head against the rock. He was so frustrated with his lack of spiritual progress and sense of unworthiness and fallenness and everything. And then he hears a child's voice outside somewhere in the neighborhood saying, I think this is in Milan, in the garden of Milan, and the voice is saying, tole lege, which is pick up and read, pick up and read. And so he looks around, he takes it as like, okay, I'm in such a, I don't have any resources to get me out of this horrible prison I'm in. What do I have? And he looks around, picks up the first thing at hand that he has to read, and it opens to, it's a letter from Saint Paul to the Romans, I believe it was, and it's this passage that just so precisely addressed his spiritual crisis in the words that were exactly in a nuanced way related to his particular spiritual and psychological conflicts around spirituality, purity, the body, sex, drunkenness, etc., versus a pure spiritual blessedness in relationship to the divine. It spoke to him so powerfully that he said it's just like all the clouds just moved away. He just felt such spiritual clarity and uplift. I mean, it shaped the rest of his life. But the reason I bring it up is it shaped the history of Western Christendom from that point on. I mean, his whole understanding of the relationship of spirituality to the body, for example, and to sexuality, as well as the conviction that he had. Here's this highly educated person, knew all the classical philosophers, Plato, et cetera, Plotinus. And at the same time, he had he knew the skeptical arguments, et cetera. And he was a professor of rhetoric, you know, at the university. And for him to come bring all that together and make an articulate defense of Christianity had a big influence on the classical world as well. pretty much the most eloquent writer of his age. And so that synchronicity, which one can see as part of the daimon working in his life to kind of pull him in that direction and into those insights, had an impact that not only brought about his individual flourishing in his own world, but also had transformational effect for a whole civilization, really, which we're still kind of working out of all the positive things that came from it and all the problematic right. sides of it as well.
Yeah. Platonism has come up a number of times, and you described Esalen in the 60s and 70s. You compared it to the Platonic Academy in Florence back in the late 1400s, right? Like around Ficino and those kind of people. Is there something about what am I trying to get at here? There seems to be like another kind of Neoplatonic revival happening now with people's interest in astrology, I think central to that. Do you think somehow that that's a reaction to monotheistic dogmatic religion, back in the Renaissance and then, in the kind of 60s till now? I mean, is it reactionary?
Well, the Platonists and Neoplatonists of the Renaissance tended to be devoutly Christian. Mm-hmm. So they integrated the Ficino, Pico, the culture was generally globally Christian. Platonism and Neoplatonism, I mean, even Giordano Bruno was a Christian. He just disagreed with the church on certain things.
Heretical Christian.
But the church and Christianity are distinct but overlapping entities. But I think there is a reaction as well that you put your finger on an important point, which is that Platonism and Neoplatonism, they provide in many ways an intellectual scaffolding, a philosophical infrastructure that Christianity in its development, both Eastern and Western Christianities, integrated Platonism as in certain ways the most the pre-Christian pagan philosophical tradition that was most appropriate for explicating certain Christian mysteries. It's not an exact fit. For example, there are certain ways in which Christianity is more incarnational than Platonism. Platonism, and Neoplatonism has a sense of that this world is less real and its multiplicity brings us farther away from the one truth, the one and also the change, the mortality, the fallenness of this world. These are all opposite the transcendent, changeless one, or the Platonic divine mind and the good, etc. And Christianity, on the other hand, has this focus on rejoining these two in a different way through the incarnation, that the suffering and dying of the divine within this mortal world brings about a radical transformation that permits a reunion of the divine and the human, the transcendent and the immanent, the spiritual and the physical, etc. That gets eclipsed in many streams of Christianity by a by an increased dualism that says this is a fallen world. We only attain to that blissful state after we die. We're dependent on Christ to, you know, come back to do that, et cetera. And so they're Christianity is both more incarnational and in some ways more can be seen as more dualistic. And it had, from Augustine in particular, had inherited a kind of juridical penal view of, you know, like punitive view of our judgment before the divine when we die. And you go to heaven or hell, maybe purgatory as that develops in the Middle Ages. And so there was just a whole atmosphere within Christianity that lost sight of some of that kind of luminous sense of that the Platonists brought in, that the archetypal not only informs everything, stands above everything in the world, informs everything in the world. Anything that's beautiful is an expression of the eternal archetypal principle of the beautiful, capital B. It has not only that sense, but it also has the sense that everything in this world is embodying, participating in the archetypal, in the eternal. Time is the moving image of eternity, as Plato put it. And so in those respects, you can see how both Platonism and Christianity have potentials for either a more dualistic view, like Plato's view of we're either in the shadow cave, the cave where we think what's real is really, but what all we're seeing is shadows on the wall. We're not seeing the actual, actually what's creating those shadows. You have to be a philosopher and break out of the cave of shadows and then see the archetypal light. Or it can have this more participatory view of the archetypal presence in this world. And Christianity, as I said, has both sides too. So it has been a very dynamic relationship between these two fundamental streams that have shaped the Western mind and spirit. One coming from the Greco-Roman tradition and Plato and Aristotle, Socrates, etc., Pythagoras, that stands as a great kind of central influence on what we've become. And then from Judaism and Christianity, that the biblical traditions, what those two streams come together in Augustine, but even in the New Testament, they're already starting to come together. But all through the Middle Ages, in the medieval universities, and then in the Renaissance in a whole new way, even informing the scientific revolution. All the scientific revolutionaries were devoutly Christian, including, you know, Descartes and Galileo, Kepler, Copernicus, but they were also Platonists. And not so much Descartes, though he had the influences there, but definitely Newton, Kepler, Copernicus. And so they're taking in both influences, and that helps produce the modernity, scientific revolution. The Renaissance is very much the fruit of those two coming together in Renaissance humanism and then influencing Copernicus, for example. It's a very richly dynamic dialectic between the Judeo-Christian traditions and the Greco-Roman traditions, and they come together to underlie the unfolding of modernity. Hillman picks up on that. Not so much even though he has been influenced by many Christian thinkers and, you know, had Jesuit educators for a while, and many of his authorities from Augustine to Ficino are Christian, even Catholic, but his major loyalty, I think, is to the Platonic Renaissance romantic tradition, Romanticism from the late 18th and 19th century. He represents that lineage. And I think it's above all because it does provide, getting back to your point about it being a reaction to monotheism and so forth, it does provide that Platonic, Neoplatonic, Renaissance, Romantic tradition going right into Jung and archetypal psychology. It has, it is carrying a sense of the numinous without all the baggage of a punitive God, for example, mm-hmm. or a, you know, all sorts of other things that come along with Christianity and Catholicism and so forth. But the numinous is still carried there, the depth of spiritual meaning. And I think he found that very important as a way of giving philosophical affirmation to his own conviction of what was going on in his own psyche and in the psyche of those he was working with.
Mm. Yeah. I have the sense that the human soul, because it's multifaceted, needs to see itself reflected in a multiplicity of the numinous of divinity. And monotheism can't meet that need. And so I think it can't last very long until it starts to break apart. Like, I think the Catholic Church tried to meet that need through creating saints, right? You get a kind of multiplicity there. But I think like the soul is always going to yearn for that. And I think maybe that's why we keep going back to these, polytheisms, whether yeah. it's Neoplatonism, the Greeks, or, you know, the Orishas, or, you know, right. kind of whatever tradition you're drawn to, the Hindu pantheon. And so I think it's like, it's just like this, the center, the monotheistic center just cannot hold what we really long for is to see ourselves in the diversity.
I think that's
astrology.
I agree. Mm-hmm. That's exactly Hillman's argument. And that when a culture like ours is going through a breakdown, it needs to reconnect to the Greek mythic background, which out of which we come. And that multiplicity does honor the multiplicity of the soul, the multiplicity of the pantheon. I like Catherine Raine's idea, Kathleen Raine, the literary scholar and writer, philosopher in England, who, when Hillman first wrote his essay, Why Archetypal Psychology, and along this idea of a polytheism of the psyche to combat the Hillman's vision of the monotheistic, rational, heroic ego that we inherit from combination of the Roman imperial monistic culture, the Christian monotheism, biblical monotheism, and the Cartesian rationality as being another form of that monotheism. And he wants to hold the polytheism. Kathleen Raine writes back in a response that Hillman published in the next journal of the spring, Journal of Archetypal Psychology. She writes, the call for polytheism is very important, but what we need is both the polytheism and the monotheism, and that the two are both playing a role. And I want to go back to hear what you're about to say, something I interjected this here while you were still in the middle of saying something, but you started to bring in astrology, and I can go there, but I want to hear what your fuller statement was going to be about polytheism, the multiplicity of the psyche and what astrology might be offering, I think is where you're going.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's behind the attraction of astrology to people these days, who have largely rejected monotheistic religion, according to, you know, all reports. But I think there's something here about what Kathleen Rain was talking about, that we need both. You know, many people have talked about this evolution of consciousness, you know, from this state of participation mystique, or like Owen Barfield called it, the original participation. Jung talked about it as kind of a lower state of consciousness, moving into something where, you know, the individual emerges out of this kind of collective mass. And so I think we're at a point now where something has to happen, because we've reached the limits of the, you know, individualism and the kind of superiority of the human self. What I've been like thinking about the past few years is like, well, just trying to imagine like what could be next. I've thought of it sometimes as the necessity to bridge the modern mind to the mythic mind, which wouldn't be a kind of full integration, but this bridging, the ability to move between two ways of being and perception, you know, as the situation calls for. I'm wondering, like, what you envision, like, what might be next, and how would the, you know, like the monotheism and the polytheism, to put it that way, how would they live together? What does that kind of look like? If you enjoyed this preview and want to hear the full episode and gain exclusive access to the first 100 episode archive, head on over to patreon.com/howl in the wilderness and join the pack. Thanks for listening.